Right, we're here with Steve, who is a researcher from Leeds Met, who's been looking into a lot of future technologies for border control. How have you been enjoying the climate camp so far, Steve?
I've only just arrived, but I'm really impressed by the energy and how people have come together and organised a tremendous event. It seems like hundreds of different activities. Energy like something from The Sprawl, Mad Max movie, but yeah, it's really good and really, really knowledgeable audience too.
Great. And in your talk, you were talking about ways in which border control may change in the 21st century. Do you think climate change will possibly lead to a new wave of migrations?
Well, I think already the US military have identified climate change as a bigger threat than terrorism, and that the climate change debate is about to militarize. It's a security issue for the United States if there's mass migration or they can't get access to the energy that they've grown used to.
What kind of new technologies can people maybe expect to see in response to this?
Well, we're seeing a general toughening of borders because of the so-called war against terror. I think that many states in the future will look towards putting in new border controls that are less permeable than the existing ones, and they vary from just enhanced surveillance along the line of borders using drones like they're using already in Mexico to more intelligent fences that can detect if anyone's approaching them so that security forces can go and find out who's approaching the fence, to victim-activated systems that will electric shock or actually fire darts at people that approach, to the one that's just emerged in this last week from Raytheon is Silent Guardian. It's a system that guards sensitive sites and can project directed energy at people and heat them up. It's a whole range of military area denial systems that are used for other purpose that will come into increasing use of borders.
Would you say that these new technologies represented a major shift in attitudes? Could they be placed in a wider political context, or would you say that it's just trying to create more efficient ways to police borders?
I don't think that the politicians have necessarily thought it through in any detail. I think that the military strategy people are looking for new roles, and part of that is that they're identifying urban warfare and the war against terror in mixed communities where they've got to seal off areas or fight against situations where combatants and civilians are in the same group. And they're the ones that are doing the thinking about perimeter protection and area denial. And of course, the corporate security companies looking for the big bucks are saying, well, we can technically fix your problems. We can find ways of using weapons that don't kill. There's a lot of mythologies around this, but there's big money to be made. And the military are saying, we can change our role. We can put forward solutions. We have answers if we're tasked. And I think that's the growth point. It's moved from very basic equipment to programs that are funded. The big shifts happened in the early 90s with people like Lieutenant Colonel John Alexander, former Green Beret commander, getting into bed with science fiction writers like Chris and Janet Morris and the futurologists Alvin and Heidi Toffler, saying that we need to have a strategic approach to the use of sublethal weaponry. And I think that's the big shift, is that the financing of these weapons has been institutionalized from a tactical thing like rubber bullets and gas sprays to strategic systems that are a very different kettle of fish.
Would you say that these new technologies pose a difficult challenge for activists? I mean, what kind of responses can people bring to such, well, to be quite frank, frightening new technologies?
So I think they pose two challenges. One is a PR challenge, because these weapons have been designed as public relations weapons. If you say plastic bullets or tear gas, the public get the impression that the authorities are being really soft. They think a plastic bullet's a squidgy little thing rather than being able to take out an eye, or that tear gas just makes you cry rather than vomit, or it's a lethal gas in closed spaces. The technology itself has a design criterion to appear rather than be safe. And the big danger to activists is that most environmental activists are conscientious people that believe in nonviolence. And that has worked. The whole Gene Sharp nonviolence set of techniques has worked because the state in the past had a choice between using very heavy-handed lethal force or backing off. What you've got with this new weaponry is technology that breaks the fire break between either lethal or nothing. And it means that they have weapons that they can use where the public would still get the impression that the authorities are using reasonable force. And I think it can create a chill factor to frighten people from demonstrating. But in the next generation, we see technologies such as chemical and biological systems, unmanned aerial vehicles, pulsed energy projectiles, science fiction type weapons using new ways of immobilizing people in a military ideology of layered defense that are about punishing people, maiming people, that go beyond the limits of the law. And I think that the environmental and activist movement haven't really started to think about this. And I think we're at that time where we need to start thinking about how we would retain nonviolence with this kind of provocation.
You mentioned something to do with political jujitsu as a possible response to this. Could you expand on that a bit for me?
Yeah, the notion comes from Gene Sharp, but it's been most amplified by an Australian researcher called Brian Martin, who said, well, just because the powers that be have more strength doesn't mean to say that disempowers the activist that's trying to make a difference. And he quotes Gandhi or the Rodney King beating, a whole range of other episodes where stronger opponents and stronger states have actually had their very actions used against them, is a form of jiu-jitsu. And he identifies a range of techniques that can be used to reframe the debate. And has recently published on the looming struggles over border control and how these techniques of political jiu-jitsu could be used in those circumstances to fight this technology in a non-violent way.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, if you could describe us a bit more detail, just as you did your presentation, how do we have to picture crowd controls in the future in terms of at borders or when there is big social unrest and so on? How do we have to picture those crowd controls?
Well, we need to start researching who is doing the work, so we've got a clear idea, because part of the impact of this technology is its surprise. Some of these technologies don't look like weapons. A taser mine looks like a bit of junk, but it's capable of putting out 50,000 volts, and we need to be able to recognize the technology when we see it. Water cannon that can spray irritants or gas on people need to be identified as such. Some of the weaponry will look like a dish on top of a vehicle that is capable of then projecting a directed energy beam of microwaves. I think it's a good question. We need to be able to recognize what these weapons look like. And they do range from unmanned aerial vehicles to areas on the ground that have been seeded with micro capsules containing malodorants or chemical irritants. We need to be able to recognize that the strange thing that is attached to a policeman's belt is actually a taser weapon. We need to see a vehicle that's got an unusual shape, might be capable of mass dissemination of gas. I think that's one of the challenges, and it's to look at the company websites and to look at people that have been working on this for the longer term, people like Landmine Action, that are looking at area denial technologies as alternative landmines, and in the first instance identify and possibly look at ways of obviating or getting around that technology. That's one of the challenges. And identifying fairly simple and easy ways of dealing with these technologies that don't make the situation worse.
And could you tell us some of the areas of application? I mean, borders or Middle East, or what are the areas where you think these weapons will be used?
Well, their big utility is for large gatherings of crowds to try and disempower people or to keep them out from particular control zones. So, they'll be used on the streets as they are already. They'll replace things like plastic bullets and gas eventually because they have a rapid reload facility. They can use just electricity to multi-shot. They'll be used at borders, but also around strategic buildings, or to keep people out, or to seal off cities, so to channel people in particular directions. Some of the technologies are airborne and can be used to attack crowds. It's anywhere where there are large gatherings of people. You know, there are other areas too, in prisons where there's no one watching. But generally, it's situations where large gatherings might mask other threats to the authorities. What we're seeing in US ideology is the idea that combatants and civilians might be attacked together in urban settings. And that's a very, very different situation. It's illegal under international law. But I would imagine that the ideology of layered defense, where the US is saying, well, we can use non-lethal weapons against crowds in the future because we think that crowd contains terrorists. And that has tremendous implications for the right to protest or for the right to assemble.
And are these weapons being tested or are they already being applied?
Well, in all the wars going around the world, there are security and policing dimensions where the authorities are using crowd control weapons, as they are in this country. The rave in Essex yesterday was broken up with chemical gas. So the police authorities are acquiring public order technologies. It's just a question of whether it's one-to-one or mass. And I think that it's a gradual series of increments. The police are like the activists. They gather at conferences. The military go to those conferences, and the companies making the technologies turn up and say, we can offer you a technical solution that will prevent your officers getting injured, or we can give you a solution to other problems you might have. I mean, some of these technologies will take out snipers by automatically recognizing where the system was fired from. So very, very gradually, the police arsenals will have options, and it's the tactical options will include crowd control elements. And you're already seeing that in this country, but more so for big events that might be terrorist targets around sporting venues. You can bet your bottom dollar when the Chinese Olympics take place, foreign, including British companies, will have supplied them with a whole arsenal of public order technologies. And it's the same where every major festival or gathering takes place. There'll be a what-if, just-in-case capacity. And very gradually, these will have some of the new technologies that I've been discussing.
Just quickly before we end, where could anyone wanting to find out a little bit more about these new developments go?
Well, you could look at the European Parliament's report, just put an appraisal of the technologies of political control. Many of these technologies have been used in human rights violations, so Amnesty International reports on torture contain what they call military security police technology, and they produced a report called The Merchants of Pain on the manufacturers and their victims. And Landmine Action have done a report on the next generation of landmines. So there's a range. And I've done a report for State Watch on mass paralysis and incapacitation technology. So my name and State Watch would get an audience access to some organized knowledge on this.
Okay. Thanks very much, Steve.
Appreciate it. Thanks.